Greetings, and welcome to another audio edition of Contentious. I'm Amy Garin with news and musings on how we communicate in the online age. Contentious is on the web at contentious.com. Today is Monday, October 3rd, 2005, and I just got back to my home in Boulder, Colorado. I was away for a few days at my annual Brain Food Festival, the conference of the Society of Environmental Journalists. I've been working with that group for, wow, I can't believe it, 15 years now, and I have a lot of good friends there. Last Saturday, October 1st, I gave a talk at that conference on blogs, feeds, wikis, and podcasts, Why Should Reporters Care? And you can see a posting to Contentious on September 28th with links about everything I discussed in that session. I was floored. I thought my session was going to be the geeky session that nobody went to because that was up against all this really cool, directly environmental stuff, and it turned out to be standing room only. In fact, the staff at the University of Texas there in Austin had to kind of bar the door and not let anybody else in so we wouldn't violate fire code. So that was pretty cool. The downside was that day I caught a cold. You can probably still hear it on my voice right now. So I wasn't quite as organized with giving the actual talk as I would have liked. There were a lot of things I wanted to go through that I didn't. And anyway, I was trying to cram way too much stuff into that time anyway. Despite that, people really seemed to like it. And a lot of people told me afterwards that they were trying to get in and couldn't. So it's a good thing that I recorded it for a podcast. So coming up next is the audio from that talk. And the quality is not fabulous, but it's listenable. And I did amplify the sections where people were asking questions because the mic wasn't directly facing them. And so in some places the background noise, you know, pops up a little bit. Hey, you know, deal with it. As always, you can email me with questions or comments at editor@contentious.com. And the show notes for this particular podcast will be the October 3rd, 2005 posting at contentious.com. And with no further ado, here is the talk that I gave on Saturday, October 1st to the Society of Environmental Journalists. Enjoy.
Hang on. Say hello, everybody. We're recording.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to my SEJ workshop. You see our voices coming up right here now. I'm Amy Garin, and I'm a geek. I've been a geek for a while, but, you know, I'm now proud of it. And believe it or not, my husband is geekier than I am. I married tech support. it's true. He thinks I like his cooking. Anyway, the reason I'm here today is because media is changing in a lot of very fundamental ways. And although we're talking to a certain extent about technology here today, what we're really talking about is changing how people think about media, use media, and interact with media to make a difference in their lives. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to run through a few tools and strategies that you can use technology for, but I'm not going to focus on the geeky stuff. I'm going to be focusing on the so what. Why should journalists and other people involved in the media care about things like weblogs, feeds, wikis, and podcasts? Now, if you are not going to be here for the whole session, or if you get caught up checking your email while I'm talking here or something, don't worry about it, because you saw the recording that I'm set up, that I've set up here. I'm going to be podcasting this later. So the one URL I want you to write down and remember is my weblog, which is contentious.com. You don't even need the blog at the front of it. Just go to contentious.com. And you want to write down the September 28th entry. That says blogs, feed, wikis, and podcasts, why should journalists care? Links for SEJ. That's the name of it. Okay, everything that I'm going to be showing you today, all the links are in that posting. And so you can go back and check all the links. You don't have to worry about writing down URLs. And if we end up showing something that I don't have a link to, I got my pad and paper here. Hi, tech. Yes. And I'm going to write down extra links and be updating that posting more later, too. Okay. So let's get started. First of all, it helps me to understand who I'm dealing with. How many people in the room are journalists, whether freelance or staff?
How many what?
People in the room are journalists. Okay, so most of you. How many of you are PR or other sorts of organizations? Okay, a few of you. How many are educators or students? Okay, so we have mostly journalists, a few PR people, and some educators and students. That's cool. All right. How many of you read weblogs currently? Any weblogs? All right, looks to be about, you know, a little less than half. That's fine. How many of you know or think you know what a weblog is? Okay. Christine, what is a weblog?
Well, it's sort of like an online diary. It's sort of like an email, but everybody gets to read it. And
there are a lot of myths about weblogs, and she just got onto the first one. We said online diary, that's what most people say. And I understand why people say that, because that's what most weblogs are used for. But here's the thing. A weblog is a tool. It is not a particular format of content. What it is a tool that allows you to manage content, whether it's news stories or what your cat ate for dinner or what, you know, audio, video, anything like that. But it allows you to manage that content in a way that gets it very connected to other people and other organizations out there on the internet in a very fast way. So stop thinking of a weblog as, you know, an online diary. Start thinking of it as a tool. That's all it is. Now, there is an article, contentious, you know, I write a lot of articles. Basically, if somebody asks me a question more than two or three times, I write an article about it, and then I just send them a link. Makes it easier. There's an article I did a few months ago called What's a Blog? Bag the Stereotypes. You might want to check that out sometime and read through it, but I'll just quickly go through some of the stereotypes, the myths about weblogs. We often say that weblogs are personal diaries, usually amateurish. A lot of them are, okay? But also, if you look at the universe, most of the universe is hydrogen gas and dust. But there's also quasars and planets. And, you know, what are you going to focus on, okay? There are a lot of very interesting things being done by weblogs. Don't let the fact that most of them are crap, basically, dissuade you from that. Some of them are great. There's also the myth that blogs aren't edited or fact-checked. Again, a lot of them are, but that doesn't mean that defines the medium. They can be. One of the weblogs that I contribute to is by the Poynter Institute, and it's called eMedia Tidbits. And eMedia Tidbits is basically a group weblog where a number of people who are experts in different types of media comment through the Poynter Institute about what, you know, various developments happening with how online media is affecting the news. Our editor is this guy, Steve Outing, friend of mine, and basically we have a closed email, there are about 25 people who contribute to this list. We have a closed email discussion group. Whenever one of us wants to post something to that list, we post it to the blog, we post it to the list, everybody gets to see it. And Steve makes the final editorial decision as to whether it merits getting on the weblog. And if anybody has any questions, remember, we've got 25 experts in various aspects of media looking at it. You better believe we rip each other apart sometimes. So if you think blogs are not edited or fact-checked, think again. It's however you want to set up the process.
How's that different than an edited listserv?
Well, you're thinking of a moderated listserv. And, yeah, and it's not really that much different, except that if I write a five-paragraph item for Tidbits, and everybody thinks it's cool, but somebody has a problem with something I put in one of those paragraphs, we can go back and forth with an editorial process and massage it before it gets published. Okay. There is a myth that weblogs don't matter because their audiences are generally small. Yes, so what? Seriously, we are used to, we've been kind of brainwashed by the mass media concept to think that the only thing that matters is having lots and lots of readers or lots of people. For some sorts of news and for some sorts of information, that matters, but by and large, it doesn't. That matters more if your business model is based upon selling eyeballs to advertisers. what matters more in online media today is niches. Are you reaching exactly the right people you need to reach to achieve your goals? Those goals could be publicizing a certain news story. It could be supporting an organization. It could be running contextual advertising. And what does contextual advertising look like? Hang on, I'll show you. My friend Dave Taylor, one of the smartest people I know. This guy's an absolute guru, and he lives right in Boulder with me. He's so cool. I take him out for lunch, and I learn everything. So Dave Taylor runs a website called AskDaveTaylor.com. It's taking a second to load here. And people ask him, all kinds of questions about technology or business, and then he answers them. You see these up here on top, these text ads? You would not believe how much people pay to get text ads placed in appropriate weblogs that are reaching exactly the right audience, because there is a much higher and more directly measurable response rate for these kind of ads, which are called contextual advertising or text ads, than you will ever see from any kind of banner ad. We used to have the advertising concept of put your ad out there and 50 million people will see that and maybe they'll remember you when they need to. What happens with contextual advertising, I love this, is there's all these people who say, I want to advertise and have my ad show up next to content that mentions this, this, and this keyword. And I'm going to bid against everybody else who wants those keywords to get good positioning. So the rate goes up. That's called the cost per click. If you write about something that is going to include keywords that has a high cost per click, you could have ads getting drawn to your site just by writing about what you would write about anyway. Okay, I'm not talking trying to pander here. I'm just saying write what you're going to write about. But you're going to attract ads that are more, your audience is more likely to be interested in than something that just randomly shows up in a banner ad system. A couple more blogging stereotypes. That weblogs are unaccountable to anyone. No. The nice thing about weblogs is, like I said, the whole point about weblogs is that they're interconnected. This is not about publishing, okay? This is where the media model has changed. It used to be about publishing or broadcasting. I'm the media, you're the audience. Not anymore. What it's about now is conversation. And weblogs are tools that really capture and enhance and support conversation. So if I post something in my weblog and Richard thinks I'm full of crap, Richard can comment, he can post a comment directly to my weblog so that people can see what I said. Richard can say, Amy, I like you, you're great, but you're full of crap on this point, and here's why. And then Richard can go and write on his own weblog, I like Amy, she's cool, but she's full of crap, and here's a more detailed explanation of why. Mm-hmm. And so some people might see Richard's and comment on his and go back to mine and comment, and it just keeps spreading and spreading and spreading. That is the level, that is the kind of accountability that happens in weblogs, and it is incredibly effective. It is not as formal as what you would have in a newsroom. And I'm not saying newsrooms are bad. I'm not saying they should go away. But I'm saying there's a different way to do quality control and information in a more collaborative and open way. And yeah, you better believe it works. Another thing that people worry about is that there are too many weblogs to follow. Yeah, there are. I don't follow all of them. Don't worry about whether you got to keep up on everything. Find a couple of weblogs that you like. Start there. See who they link to. Grow out from there. Don't try to overwhelm yourself. If you're not having fun with this, you're not doing it right, whether you're reading it or creating weblogs. And a lot of people think weblogs mainly talk about politics or political blogs are the only one that matter. Yeah, right. That is what a lot of journalists who don't understand weblogs tend to publish about weblogs, that it's all about political ones. And it's not. There are weblogs on everything. In fact, there is a list of environmental weblogs that I and a few other people put together for SEJ. And it's on the SEJ site, but I've also archived it in a more effective place called Blog Digger, which allows you to see and I have this link on this page, but if you go to the EnviroBlogs group on Blog Digger, I've got probably about 40 or so very good environmental weblogs, and this kind of aggregates them into one big blog. Anything that anybody posts to one of these weblogs on that list shows up as if it's one big weblog here. You know, so if you posted something, and you posted something, and you posted something all this morning on three different weblogs, if I have them aggregated into a group in Blog Digger, they're all going to show up in one place. So if you want to read environmental blogs very easily, this is a good place to start. Or you could subscribe to them individually too. It's no big deal. Okay, so what? All right, there's all these weblogs out there, and you got to kind of, you know, do quality control for yourself and judge information for yourself and get in contact. It sounds really time-consuming. It sounds a lot less convenient than reading the newspaper. Yeah, it is. I'm not going to kid you there. But who here wants to work in 10 years? I'm serious. Okay, a lot of you work for newspapers, for instance. And a big part of newspapers, bread and butter, has been classified advertising. Have you ever heard of something called Craigslist? Mm-hmm. It's killing your business model. Craigslist is basically an online matching service where people can post classified ads and find out who's selling a used Ford Mustang in Boulder, Colorado. Really easy.
Or San Francisco.
It's global now. And Craigslist is expanding into news in some interesting ways, too, which we can get into later. The bottom line is that the business models for mass media organizations, whether they are newspapers or magazines or broadcasts, have been focused on the idea of controlling information or controlling access to information. Bruce is looking. Okay, you can respond to me later. But in terms of, you know, we are gathering the information and we're disseminating the information. We are the main channel. We are the main point of contact. And there's a need for that. But in terms of business models, when the access to information is wide open and people can access it in more and better ways, and especially the next generation of people growing up are used to accessing the information in ways that are flexible for them and amenable to their mentality on it, okay, your business model for a newspaper kind of goes out the window. And if you don't think so, start talking to more 15-year-olds. Okay, because they're going to be your market. And if they're not reading you now, there's a reason why. Because news organizations are not serving their needs. News organizations are not making news as findable and convenient through the channels as they need it to be. So that's changing. And it's not universal. I'm not saying the New York Times is dying, okay? I'm saying that the dynamic is changing. And if you want to be able to work, the more flexible you can be, and these tools offer flexibility, the better. Okay, hang on a second. Let me just get through quickly a few things about weblogs and feeds, and then we can kind of open it up, and then I can kind of go in any direction you want. But a couple of things I wanted to tell you about weblogs are, first of all, how do you find ones you like? Well, it's not as easy as it should be. It's getting easier. But, you know, you're not going to go to Google and say, tell me the top three weblogs dealing with occupational safety and health. Okay, because Google, if you type in occupational safety and health, will list all the websites in order of what they think is authoritative and popular. That could be, you know, reference sites from OSHA, and it could be, you know, some university site, but it probably isn't going to be news-oriented stuff that happens every day. There are special search engines, and a couple of them that I'm going to show you are Technorati is one of them. Okay, and I do have a link to this. It's technorati.com. It's technorati.com. And the main Technorati site looks at about 18.6 million weblogs and other sites that offer something called a feed, which we'll get into in a minute. And we'll tell you what's new. So if we did a search in Technorati on PCBs and Austin, It will look at those 18.6 million feeds, some of which come from news organizations, by the way. It's not just about weblogs. And tell you what's new. Now, in contrast, if we were to go to Google and type into the Google toolbar here, PCBs and Austin, okay, what do we get? PCB Service Bureau is right up top, and basically a lot of informational material. It's not about what's new. If what is interesting you is following the news, you want to start using different search engines like Technorati and Feedster and that sort of thing. I've got links to them again on the site. Okay. Now, Technorati has just launched, and it's a little bit buggy, and it's not perfect. Give them time, okay? Their heart is in the right place. They mean well. If you go to the main Technorati site, there's a tag up top that says blog. Blogs. What they're doing is trying to make it possible, there we go, for blogs to be categorized. Because the problem so far with finding weblogs is it's been very easy to find particular postings in a weblog that deal with a certain topic. It's been difficult to find what is the best weblog that generally deals with a whole topic. What Technorati is trying to do is allow people who create weblogs and people who read them to categorize the weblog as a whole with certain keywords. And hang on a second, let's see what we got. Let's try environment. Remember, this is not something where you got some expert who's saying, yeah, this is a really good environment blog. No, this isn't. This is something that's done collaboratively by all the people who use Technorati, both the people who publish weblogs and others. Okay, so let's see. So far, they've got a bunch of weblogs dealing with environment, and these are, like I said, self-proclaimed and then also rated by people reading them. And if you're looking for a weblog that deals with a certain topic, check this Technorati blog finder first. And like I said, they just launched it like 2 weeks ago, so there are a lot of keywords that aren't in there yet. I mean, probably if you put PCBs in there, there might be nobody who's tagged an entire weblog as PCBs yet. But, for a lot of the larger topics, yeah, you can find a lot of good places to start. They rank them by inbound links. So it's inbound links generally from other weblogs. So there is a little bit of kind of how many people think this is worth reading. And it's a mixed bag, but it's a way to start. Google also just started its own service, very similar, a kind of blog finder service, that does basically the same thing. And Feedster as well. So if you see how one of them works, it's basically how all of them works, but if you don't get good results from one, try the others because they're all looking at a slightly different set of feeds. So it's worth checking out. Now, why would you want to do a weblog? I'll tell you why I do it. It is my bread and butter. And I don't make much money directly off of it, but I'm a self-employed professional. Almost all my clients have come to me because of my weblog. I use my weblog to establish my expertise and my reputation, to show that, hey, I actually know what I'm talking about in this field. I use my weblog to engage in the public conversation, both with colleagues and potential clients and with basically anybody who needs some help that I feel like I can give them a hand, because, you know, I'm incorrigible that way. And also, what's good about doing a weblog is you can design how you do your weblog in a way that really suits you. Again, if you are not having fun, first of all, and if you don't personally feel energized when you sit down to do a weblog, you're not doing it right. It is totally up to you to do the content strategy. Now, a lot of people will say, well, you need to build massive traffic, and then you need to be able to post several items a day. And no. Really, people who do that strategy can get a lot of traffic, and sometimes the quality is good. Oftentimes, it completely sucks. Quality is what counts, and quality is what is going to help you build a relationship with your audience. Again, think strategy. What do you want to achieve? If your goal is just to make money, go sell crack. Don't do weblogs, okay? If you have other goals, and making money can be part of it, can be a byproduct of these things, then figure out what your goals are. Then figure out who do you need to reach as specifically as possible in order to achieve those goals, then use a weblog to get into conversation with those people. And if they're not already using weblogs, still publish on a weblog, contact them through other ways and say, hey, actually I've been writing about that, and you don't even have to say on my blog, just say on my site, because a weblog is, after all, kind of website. You know, you don't got to freak them out by using the blog word. And then say, all right, now I've started this here. You see that link on the bottom that says comment? I'd really like to hear what you have to say. And a lot of people do comment back. And the more you can make your weblog involved in part of the conversation, the more engaging it's going to be and the more attention it's going to get. You had a question?
Yeah, a question. Since you're a geek into all this kind of activity, how many people, percentage of America, access computers? And then from that, how many of those are involved with, in one form or another, blogs?
I don't have all the statistics, and the statistics that I've seen are questionable because it's a very difficult thing to measure. For instance, a lot of people who are homeless use the internet, and they don't have their own computers, and they typically fall through the cracks in all sorts of statistics. So I don't have the statistics for you. However, I will tell you this. Most schools in America have some sort of internet access, even if it's just a dial-up terminal, and the students are all over that. So regardless of what the population is doing today, like I said, think 5-10 years down the line about what's going to be happening. This is something that's incredibly popular within the upcoming generation, and they have a strong preference for this rather than from print and broadcast media in most cases. So there was a study that was done by the Pew Internet and American Life Project that said that 6 million there are 6 million Americans reading blogs right now, and they expect it to grow by something like 20% per year for the next 10 years. But there's a lot of people shooting holes in that research, too, so that's why I'm hesitant to quote statistics. Now, here's the interesting thing, though. A lot of things that get published in weblogs get picked up elsewhere. They get distributed on email lists. They end up getting republished in print. They end up... All the major news programs... news channels now have shows where they have people sitting there in front of a computer on the TV screen reading the weblogs. Okay, there are all sorts of ways that people are being exposed to this medium, directly and indirectly. So, if you're looking for statistics, you're going to get frustrated. I have, because I've looked for them. Yes.
Okay, so you're the person essentially administering this moderated list for all intents and purposes. Is that the idea? So how do you keep out spam? How do you keep out penile implants and
he asked how you keep out comment spam, and how you get people to not advertise Viagra in your comments and all that. It is, weblogging tools have a number of functionalities built into them, and comments is one of them. A weblog does not have to have comments. There's a weblog that's done by Randy, I forget what his last name is. He's one of the big execs at Boeing. He uses a weblog tool to basically post commentaries on things that are happening in the industry. And it's pretty popular. The guy's actually a reasonably good writer. Either that or he's got a great editor. And you can't post a comment to that weblog. Is it still a weblog? Yeah. He just decided not to allow comments. All the good weblogging tools, and I only recommend that you use the good weblogging tools because they're free or cheap, first of all, but allow you to moderate comments and moderate something else called trackbacks, which we'll get into a little bit later, but it's another way that weblogs stay connected. When you are first setting up your weblog, you can configure that weblog to have whatever the functionality you want that works for you and that works for your audience. And, for instance, with my weblog, Contentious, I run it off of a piece of free open source software called WordPress. I get probably 1,000 comment spams a day because my weblog is very popular. I get about 7,000 unique visitors to Contentious per day, and when spammers see something that popular, they're going to try to get something in it. What I do is I just go through and look at the list of comments, literally just scrolling down through it fast, because the comment spams tend to look, they tend to use the same format, and I go through and just mark everything that doesn't fit the comment spam format, take it into a second level of moderation, look at that subset a little more closely, see which are real comments, and then I only approve them. I do that about every two or three days. Also, it sends me an email when a comment comes through, and if I can see right away that Francis was saying, "Wow, Amy is cool," then I can approve it right then. So there are a lot of different ways you can go about it. You can moderate comments, and you can do things that are far more sophisticated than what I just described.
So you don't necessarily have to manually go through everything?
No. No, what a lot of places do, and what I'm actually going to implement for contentious, is they have, let's call it a robot screener, where they'll show you a little bit of text that's a little off-center, visually screwy, because it's hard for software to go through and look at it. And it's kind of testing whether you're a person or not. And so you can have that be part of your comment system, too. And actually, I'm going to implement that for contentious.
Did you say 7,000 comments?
No, I get about 7,000 unique visitors a day to contentious, and then I get probably about 1,000 comment spams, people trying to advertise Viagra on my site and stuff every day. But like I said, I've got ways to deal with that. And if you're first starting out, the spammers aren't really going to care about you. So really, if you're first starting out, don't get hung up on what are we going to do about comment spam. You'll get the hang of it. You'll learn how to deal with it later. Okay, let me get through a couple of more things here before I take more questions, because I just wanted to get a bit of a basic picture together. Okay. Those of you who are on the SEJ list might have seen that I've started an unofficial conference blog. And I could have done a better job with... Oh, hang on a second. There we go. I could have done a better job with it. I could have publicized it better, gotten a domain. I threw this together in literally 5 minutes when I was in between getting ready for this tour. So this is something that I created with a web-based tool that is the one that I recommend for people who are just getting started in web blogging. It's called TypePad, TypePad, and I do have a link from it from the site. The thing about TypePad is that it is a completely web-based and hosted tool. It's a service you pay for, basically. It's cheap. Their top-level service is something like $11 or $13 a month. And you can run as many weblogs as you like off of TypePad. But they have a lot of default designs, settings, and then when you do postings, it's all in a web-based form. And they automate all the functions that you would possibly want automated. So literally, I did set this weblog up in about 5 or 10 minutes.
And how do you need that URL to get there?
Yes. Yes, right now it's agaron.typepad.com/SEJ2005. And which is not ideal. Usually I like to actually get a domain for a blog and map it over to it. But like I said, this time, okay, I was busy. You get what you get. But here's the thing, though. I set this up on TypePad very quickly, and it was about a project. Now imagine that, Ken, you're doing a project with your students. And your students are trying to understand how to cover water quality, or something along those lines. You could have them do a reporting project where the publication is done on a weblog, and it doesn't just have to be text. You could put photos, you could put links to audio or video, whatever you want. But this is something that a weblog doesn't just have to have one author. You could set it up so that a defined group of people has the ability to post this weblog. And the nice part about it is that your students' content, if they're using, good keywords that people would actually search for in the content of their postings, could end up as visible in searches as Andy Revkin's stuff in the New York Times. So that's one way to do it. And if you are working on a project that is ongoing, say that you are trying to uncover the long-term legacy of mining in some community, in your coverage area. And this is something that's going to take you a year to do the research on. Would it be nice to get some support going from the community for this and say, hey, I'm just starting to cover this, and here are the issues I'm looking at, and I'd like to know if anybody has this kind of information, and then you publicize that weblog within the community. This is something that's getting known as open source journalism, where reporters are inviting the audience into the reporting process, and weblogs are a key tool for accomplishing that. Okay, let's see. What else did I want to tell you about weblogs? All right, that's a lot about weblogs. But are you starting to get the picture that there are a lot of different purposes you can put them to? Whether you're working for a news organization or trying to promote yourself as a professional or sell ads or whatever, there's a way you can use this tool to do it. But the beauty of it is that it makes you connected. Okay, if you post something to your website, it could take days, weeks, or months for Google to index it. And it probably won't get ranked very highly right away. If you publish something, the same content, using a weblogging tool, and that goes out on your feed, again, I will explain what they are, those search engines like Technorati and all that stuff will rank it right up number one right away because it's new. And people, you know, looking for that content can find it right away. Now, let me just move on quickly to feeds. I will have plenty of time for questions and answers, but these are two concepts that work together very well. Probably most of your questions will get answered once you see this. What is a feed? A lot of times people call them RSS feeds, Atom feeds, okay? Ignore the geeky terms, just call them feeds, okay? There are a bunch of geeks who think RSS is a good name for something. They're dead wrong. But all it is when you use a weblogging tool or any other kind of content management system, to put a piece of content, whether it's a story or a photograph or whatever, into your site, there's a little function that creates a separate file in something called XML. Don't worry about it. Okay? But it's an ongoing list of what is the new stuff posted to this site. What's the headline, maybe keywords that you've associated with it, what kind of content is it? Is it a picture? Is it text? Whatever. What language is it in? And so then that feed sits there on a web server. Any of you can subscribe to that feed by using a tool called a feed reader. And to warn you, I have a tutorial that I've written, and I got a link to it here, what are feeds and why should you care? All the details about what you need to know about how to subscribe to feeds and everything are in there. I've already answered all those questions. So you have a feed reader. And you like my blog, okay? You think I'm cool. But you're never going to remember to visit it every day. And I don't post every day. This month, I haven't been posting that much, and people are starting to get mad at me. And so what you would want to do is just grab the address for that file that sits on my web server, that feed file, and plug it into your feed reader, okay? And then every time I post something new, it says, well, yo, Amy's got something new. So here's what it looks like. I use a feed reader. Feed readers can be services that live on the web that you don't have to install anything onto your computer. I happen to use one. This is the web browser Firefox. There's a plugin for that called Sage.
Amy,
yes.
I'm starting to get lost.
Okay.
Am I not?
Sure.
Okay.
All right, hang on a second. So the concept of feeds is they tell you what's new. They are a way for you to find out what's new without having to get an email alert that's going to get lost in your mailbox or probably eaten by your spam filter. And it is a way for you to sort through that content very easily and find it quickly. What Sage is doing here, this little sidebar that came up, these are all the feeds I subscribe to. Personally, I have about 510 feeds that I subscribe to. Do I read them all every day? No. But when I find a weblog that I really like or a news source that has feeds that I really like, I'm going to subscribe to it because I want it. If I'm interested in what they have to say, I don't care about what the organization is about. I'm concerned about what are they saying today. This is the easy way to do it. For instance, if this guy, I live in Boulder, Colorado, this guy, John Orr, keeps up, he basically links to all the good content about water issues in Colorado. And if I want to get clued in on what's going on, this guy is basically doing all my press clippings for me. And he's writing about, he sometimes does a little bit of original reporting. Most of the time he says, here's an article, and here he'll put that article into a larger context. What we're looking at here is how it looks in the feed reader, which is just I can scroll through it, and very quickly, you know, see what's going on. You know, all the different articles that he's posted to his blog. Now, if I want to see them in a cleaner format, I just click on the headline, and that takes me to his weblog. In this case, it was a very short link, but sometimes people can do a summary that goes out to the feed, and if you want to read the full article, you click on the headline, and it takes you there. Yes?
So when you click on the feed on the left-hand side, that just showed you what was new on this guy's site?
Yep.
Since the last time?
Yep. And now, look at this. You see, his is not highlighted anymore. All the rest are highlighted, so I can see what have I already checked. And what's useful about this is that you can also, you know, set up a defined list of feeds, you know, weblogs that you really like, and say, I want to know when anybody in this group of like 15 weblogs or other feeds says anything about PCBs in Austin. And then it will flag that for me in a special way. Okay, there are all sorts of feed readers. If you want to get started easily, the easiest way to get started is a web-based service that's free. I love free. Called NewsGate. And again, this is on the links page. You go in, you set up a free account, and they make it easy for you to subscribe to feeds. Again, this lives on the web. So if you're working on your computer at work and then your computer at home or you're on the road, you can have access to your list of feeds from anywhere that you can have internet access. And they've got a bunch of higher level services too, but let me just show you what it looks like. Because it looks a little nicer than Sage, so that's why I thought I'd show you. It might make a little more sense.
And this is a feed reader?
Yes, it's a feed reader service.
These feed readers are essentially robots?
No. All the feed reader does is it's a piece of software or a service that you say, I want you to check these feeds periodically. Each feed has its own URL. It has its own address. It's that XML file sitting on the web. You say, I want to read Christine's feed. I want to read Jane's feed. I want to read Ken's and Bruce's and Richard's. Okay? And you put all those URLs into the list. It goes and checks those files as often as you want, usually once every 2 or 3 hours.
It'd be like having multiple wire services.
Yes.
Coming in.
Yes, it'd be like having multiple wire services coming in. And anytime something is new from any of those feeds you've subscribed to, it has a way of visually presenting it and flagging that for you. And delivering that content to you sometimes in ways that you could read it offline, off the internet. So that's very helpful.
Are you checking weblogs and web pages?
It's checking anything that has a feed. Okay. For instance, EPA, their website, now has a collection of feeds, finally. You can get a feed for any of the regions and according to a lot of different topics because they flag their press releases and other content according with keywords, and they just, you know, anything that gets flagged with, say, toxics goes into the toxics feed. So most of the time it's press releases, but there are some things from other sites. So that's not a weblog, but they use a content management system that they can generate feeds from. And by the way, if your favorite sources don't offer feeds yet, bug them. Because I have a link to this, I've set up a form letter that you can use to say, okay, here's what feeds are and here's why they matter and do you want me to read your stuff or not? Because I'm bagging your press releases as soon as they come in. And they will start offering feeds because it's technically easy for them to do so. Okay, now, the big picture is staying connected. Weblogs, the tool makes it easy to generate a feed. There are other ways to generate feeds. Feeds are what gets you connected and get people alerted as to what your content is new today. And it also allows you to find stuff. For instance, one last thing I want to show you about feeds. Okay. I got an unusual last name. Not a lot of people have it, you know, Gahran. So, you know, I could go to Feedster every couple days and plug it in and see if anybody's talking about me. A couple of these are me talking about myself. But people do talk about me because I write a lot of things. Like here, Lee Hopkins is a guy I know in Australia who wrote an article where he mentioned me there. And what is this? Okay. When you see these ugly little orange or blue buttons that say something geeky like XML, RSS, RDF, whatever, all right, really, really bad usability here. But when you see these buttons, what that means is On Feedster, you can generate a feed from that search, which means you can, in your feed reader, subscribe to anything that comes in on Feedster that says, Garen, I'm going to know about it right away. That's useful. Now, here's how it looks in my feed reader, because I've done this. All right, here's my dirty secret. You see this folder, Ego Surfing? This is how I find out what people are saying about me? That's exactly what I've done. I've gone to all these different services that allow me to do a feed based on a search, and I've, you know, I can go and see every day what's new, who's talking about me, and if somebody is complaining about me, well, I can get involved in that, which is helpful. Anybody who's involved with journalism where somebody is saying you got your facts wrong, or public relations, I mean, yeah, duh, that's obvious. You can find out what's going on. And this is not just about you, though. I mean, I'm an egotist. I'll admit that. And, you know, I'll go and check and say, oh, who's you know, checking me out here? But you can also do it for any kind of topic you want. For instance, one of the things I do is I coach people on how to do weblogs well. One of my clients is a virtual assistant, and she's training other people how to be virtual assistants. She has, in all these major feed search engines, a search based on the phrase virtual assistant. And every time that comes in, she sees what's going on in the field and who's talking about it. That helps her R&D process. That helps her figure out what she's going to be writing about and what people are going to be interested in. Okay, we've covered a bunch of ground here so far. Now I'm going to take a break for questions on blogs and feeds, and then we'll move on to podcasts and wikis in a little bit. This is the meatiest part, though, the blogs and feeds. All right, so go for it.
Yeah.
How often does the scanner service search the new, or how often does your...
You can customize that.
So you can have it go every 3 hours, you can have it do every 24 hours.
Yeah, I would recommend don't set it for anything less than 2 hours, just because... some servers, if they see your feed reader pulling it too frequently, it puts a demand on their server, and they'll block you. Okay? But, you know, generally, I have most of them set for once a day. But then you can also check it anytime you want, too, if something's happening. But, yeah, you can customize. That's the nice thing about all these tools. If you're going to ask me, can it do this? The answer is probably yeah. You just got to figure out how to customize it. Jane.
How can you integrate a blog into a conventional website? What's the process?
No. This is where feeds get really cool. Okay. You have a conventional website, but you want to use a blogging tool to make your content more connected and more findable, the way we talked about before. You actually enter the content into your blogging tool, because after all, it's just a content management system. You don't even have it published to the web. All you do is then publish that content to a feed rather than its own website. And then, over here in your website, you got a layout, and you've got a column in there that's going to be your top stories for the day. Mm-hmm. Okay, in that column, you're going to run in that column whatever the top five items are that come off of your feed. And then when people click to it, to those stories, they get taken to the page that's generated by the weblog tool. It all looks like one site, and it's all under one domain. But just to actually publish the news content or press releases or whatever you're doing, you use the blogging tool to create it, because it makes it so much easier to use that content flexibly. So it still looks like a regular website.
So when they click the back button, they'll be directed somewhere else on their website. You're not getting directed to some whole other third site.
Okay. Correct, yeah. Yeah. You can do that where you have the weblog that's... If you do want to do something like that, I recommend that you, instead of using a service like Typepad that's hosted on their servers, that you get some weblog software, and there are tons of really good packages out there. Like I said, most of them are free. And the one I use is WordPress. Some people use something called Drupal, and I've got links to a bunch of good ones. But the thing is, if you have the blogging software on your server under the domain, there's no issues of, is it going to be going to a different site? It's just going to a set of files that's created by another piece of software.
So on your website, it's basically a link to your blog site.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not a separate site, though.
No, I understand.
It's just a different way to manage the files, yeah. Okay, other questions? Ken?
You said you put the software on your server.
If you don't have a server, well, if you have a website, you have a web host somewhere. Because, most web hosts have weblog software that they will let their customers use. So if you don't run your own server, but your site is hosted somewhere, contact your web host and ask them what weblog tools they already have installed on their server. And if they say they don't have any, ask again, because they do. Because everybody does this now, it's big business. They might want to charge you a setup fee for a blog, but there really shouldn't be any ongoing costs for maintaining the blog, because it should just be all part of your site. Yes. She had a question back here. Yes.
I work for a federal government agency, and so we have proposed rules and stuff for ours, but out for public comment, I guess I think this would be a really good way to make it more accessible for people. Do you know any government agencies who are using this to kind of...
FERC. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission just started using this as part of their comment process. It doesn't mean that anybody can actually read anything they write. Okay, the content still sucks, but you know it's more available and it is being used as part of the comment process. Correct, and there are also places that are using feeds to offer statistics like air or things like air quality alerts. It doesn't have to be articles. There are some that do like photo of the day. There are some stock houses that use feeds to let people know what the new photographs are coming in, for their content. All right, there are all sorts of ways you can use this.
What agency do you work for, and why haven't you been fired yet? Information out there.
They don't know what I'm going to suggest yet. That's why.
And again, a lot of what I do is I go into places and explain this. So if you guys work for newsrooms or agencies or whatever, and you're like, okay, I kind of get what Amy was talking about, but I'm not quite sure. Let me know. I can help you out because I like people to get this. Yes.
Are there other side benefits that you can describe associated with setting up a publication website the way you suggested using the blog in addition to...
Yeah, the management of it is much easier. Don't you hate it when you post something to a website and then you're like, oh, God, I got this number wrong, and then you have to go and wait for the designer to go and implement the change that you update? That's not the case with a weblog tool. You just log right back into the content management system and do it yourself. Okay. And it can streamline a lot of processes. It also, I think the biggest benefit, though, and I can't overstate this, is getting involved in the conversation. And it's not just the conversation with your audience, but with your colleagues. Here's the thing. A lot of places are using weblogs internally on intranets. And I know they do this at the Washington Post. They use both wikis and weblogs at the Washington Post internally on their intranet so they can discuss editorial issues and coverage issues. And this is private. But the thing is, it's a way for them to capture the knowledge. It's like if you figured out the best way to get a certain government document that people have been pulling their hair out trying to get, you write a quick article and here's how I did it. And somebody else searching on the in-house weblog can find that.
Can you explain what a wiki is?
Yes. Okay, wikis are next. Can we move on to wikis?
Yes.
All right. Wiki is not an acronym. It is a Hawaiian word for quick, and I have no idea where they picked it. But basically what a wiki is it's another type of content management tool. And again, you can use it any way you want. How many of you have heard of something called Wikipedia?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. This is Wikipedia. It is an online encyclopedia that anybody can edit, and it is becoming one of the interesting parts of the news right now. They have literally about 100,000 people all over the world who log into Wikipedia and create pages to explain something. And then you can create more pages to explain related topics, and you can create links between those pages, and anybody can edit it. Now, a lot of journalists are like, how can you trust this if anybody can edit it? If you got 50 people, I'd say, how can you trust this? Here you got more than 100,000. And it's fascinating because on the most contentious topics, Wikipedia tries to create consensus and tries to show where things diverge. For instance, okay, here's one that's going to be contentious. Let's look at the wiki page on the People's Republic of China. People got a lot of different opinions on that. Well, you see in here, it's got all these links. These are all separate pages in Wikipedia where people have gone and explained things. And I'm not going to go and show you the edit mechanism because it's easier to understand the concept than to actually show because the interface is ugly. But if I wrote something here about political status of Taiwan and somebody else says, no, you left off one of the provinces here, and I need to add that in there. They can basically get it, open up that page and edit it and add that link to something that I wrote. Okay? And like I said, the thing is that if you're dealing with a wide open wiki, but you only have a few people contributing to it, accuracy and credibility are going to be a problem. But when you have a large number of people contributing to it, you get the most amazing clarity on a lot of issues. And one thing that's interesting is whenever a big news story breaks, like Hurricane Katrina, go to Wikipedia, because see the page in Wikipedia and watch it every few days to see how it develops. And any time, and give back to it. Anytime you see something you think is questionable or if you have additional information, put into it. And this grows and it is phenomenal. And I don't use it ever as the end-all and be-all source when I'm, like, I do articles for SCJ Tip Sheet. I don't use it as the end-all and be-all source for everything. However, I use it as leads. Because you will find the most comprehensive list of resources on any topic you can imagine in Wikipedia. And I defy anybody to beat that. And here's the big thing about wikis is some of you may have heard of a thing the LA Times did called Wikitorials. All right? I don't know what bonehead came up with that idea at the LA Times, but it was stupid because they set it up as an adversarial process. We're going to put our most contentious editorial up there, and we're going to let people duke it out, okay? And it just degenerated into a big flame war. What wikis are good for is consensus. When you are trying to get people to arrive at consensus or to at least agree where they disagree, map out the areas of disagreements, that's where wikis work. Now, wikis don't only have to be public. Wikipedia obviously benefits from being as wide open to editing as possible. However, you can do private wikis or semi-private wikis. And this is where it gets interesting, especially for journalists or for anybody who's managing a project. One of the things I do is I create online courses. And when I'm working with other people on creating those online courses, I use a tool called SeedWiki. This is not a free tool, but it's cheap. It's $10 a month, and you get to run as many wikis as you want. And they have a free version, but you don't get to password protect it. I pay for it, so I get to create password-protected wikis. And if I go to my account here, here's one of the wikis I'm working on. I'm developing a course for Poynter's News University right now and covering hospitals. I'm working with two journalists, Charles Orenstein from the LA Times and Carl Stark from the Philadelphia Inquirer, who know a hell of a lot more about covering hospitals than I do since I've never done that. All I do is assemble their information into a course. Well, they got all this facts, and they had some presentations that worked really well with slides and all that, but in terms of an interactive course that people will go through, their existing presentation didn't work that well. So we are using this wiki to take all their content and collaboratively, between the three of us, well, four of us, plus the designer at Poynter, are going through and saying, well, I think if we move this up here and then if we handled the interactivity this way, it would work better. We are all of us working on creating this document. Now, the nice thing is with this tool is that when we're done, I can export the entire wiki as basically web pages, as HTML files, which will allow us to import that into Poynter's system for delivering e-learning. So a lot of the work will already be done. A lot of the pages will already be created. We'll just have to basically apply the design to them and fine-tune them. But, you know, it's like if I am working on this page and I want to edit something, I just hit the edit this page. And I can go through and say, go to the website of the HHS Inspector General, and you can, you know, apply URLs to that. This hospital says which hospitals have paid federal fines to resolve patient dumping allegations. Okay, but I can add in here, I'll add a query. And I just flag them visually. I can be more sophisticated about it. I'd say, what about state fines? Okay, Carl Stark at the Philadelphia Inquirer, this is his subject area. He can go through and search for all my queries and say, what questions did Amy have about what I did? And he can look through and say, oh, wow, Amy had a question about this. Well, I'll go back and fix that. Save my changes. And that's part of the wiki now. So the next time Carl gets in there, he'll be able to find what my questions are and work on that. Now imagine if you are reporting on, say, a landfill, that there's going to be a landfill closure, and there's you deal with all kinds of bureaucracy, and you're dealing, it's crossing from the business beat to the environment beat to the metro beat to all sorts of things. You got reporters that have expertise all over the place within your news organization. You start a wiki about the issue or about the specific project, and then anybody who has access to it, who has something can contribute to it, can then say, all right, well, if you're trying to go through the Municipal Solid Waste Agency, these are the best sources you want. Don't talk to this guy because he will only lie to you. And this is inside the newsroom. Okay, this is not something that's public on the website. This is just a tool for reporters to share information. This is especially useful if you're collaborating over a distance across different offices or even other countries. I've got other wikis that I'm working on about certain publishing projects, where with one of them I'm working with people from 6 different countries. And we are all collaborating on the same document, the actual same document. And it's helpful in that way. Yes?
You can put in graphics?
Yeah, you can add any kind of thing. See how it's got page files here? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's where you could upload files associated with a certain page. Now, SeedWiki is a very rudimentary tool. It's not very graphic intensive. And a lot of wikis, you know, they're meant to be functional, so they're kind of ugly. All right, I'm sorry about that, but get used to it. And just look at the beauty of what they actually do. But yeah, you can associate files, audio, video, anything you want.
Did you tell us already what, I probably missed it, what program you use or how to get the program or the
okay,
software?
I use SeedWiki because I'm tired of asking my husband to install software on the server for me because he's got too many other things to do. So SeedWiki is, like I said, it's a web-based service, and I do have a link to it from that posting in Contentious that I mentioned earlier. But there are other tools, like, for instance, a tool that supports Wikipedia and another site that's related to Wikipedia, Wikinews, is called MediaWiki. I've got a link to that, too. That is wiki software that is free, open source. Anybody can download it. It has to be installed on the server, though, because it's not something that runs on your PC, just on your desktop. It's something that if you want other people to be able to connect to it, it has to be on a server where they can access it. However, now, I love this. Okay, you guys have to promise not to laugh at me here. Okay. This is a little tool called VoodooPad. It's a personal wiki. This is my backup brain. I think about weird stuff all the time, and it all just goes in there. All right, I forget where I put it right now. So good, I'm not going to embarrass myself. But basically, if I wanted to make a new wiki here, and let's say this is the SEJ workshop wiki, and I wanted to say, I want to remember to explain more about FERL if I get time, and I want to explain more about the public conversation and how that works. Okay, and what can I mean by these? Well, if I just highlight it and click link, this is a new page. I say, FERL is cool, okay? And this, when I use a word that has already been designated as a page name, it automatically links back to it. Okay, I mean, there's all sorts of functionalities built into wiki tools. And the thing is that if you cover a beat for a long time, you might want to start a personal wiki because everything you put in there is searchable. And what's more important about it is that it not only preserves the information, it preserves all the connections. Why did this fact matter to you? Why was this document? What story were you working on when you came across this source? Those are all connections that you can preserve more easily in a wiki than in a word processing file or scribbled notes on a pad. So it's a different way of dealing with information, and I know we just went over a bunch here. Who has questions about wikis? Jeff?
10 minutes.
Yes.
And you only took this because you haven't got the iPod.
iPod, yeah.
Okay, podcasting. Okay, no, well, hang on a second.
Is that right?
No.
Am I wrong?
10:45, right. Podcasting. We talked about blogs. We talked about feeds. Podcasting is just an extension of this. All a podcast is a downloadable, usually an audio file, an MP3 format, that you post on your server and associate either with a blog entry or with an item on a feed. Then you have a special feed reader that basically goes and checks to see, are there any new media files it's attached to the feed. So iTunes, for instance, the popular software that Apple has, that you can run it on any program, it doesn't have to be Mac, has a podcatcher built into it. You say, I want to subscribe to Jeff's show about chemical safety. And every, 2 weeks, Jeff has something brilliant to say, okay? And, so my feed reader goes and checks and checks and checks. Is there a new MP3 file? Yes, grabs it, puts it on my computer. I hook up my MP3 player, download it, go out for a jog, and listen to Jeff Groove about chemical safety, okay? The interesting thing about podcasting is that it can play off of your strengths. If you are not a great writer, but you're a really great speaker, this can be an excellent way to communicate more effectively. It also, the human voice is very engaging. Also, it allows you to have new markets for your radio programming. I've just posted on the 29th some great environmental podcasts. If you want to get into podcasting, these are the feeds you're going to want to subscribe to. One of them, this is very interesting, is the great, you guys know the Great Lakes Radio Consortium? Yeah, several of their producers are SEJ members. They do features that are independently produced and that end up getting run in a lot of public radio stations all around the country. But they don't have a radio show per se. They're just farming out features. Well, what Lester Graham decided to do over there is, what Lester Graham decided to do, he's one of the producers there, is take all those features that they do in a given week or 10 days and just kind of put them all together into a show that, runs about a half hour to 40 minutes long. And he just records a little intro and outro to it, and they have a podcast. Now, here's the interesting thing. It hasn't exactly, been huge numbers of people subscribing to their podcast, but they're starting to get inquiries from more stations because people in other markets who have never heard of the Great Lakes Radio Consortium get the podcast and say, hey, this is cool stuff. Can we start running some of this on our local public radio station? Okay, so they end up getting inquiries for something that's related to their core market.
Amy, is there a recommended length for a podcast? Is it all over the map?
It depends on what you do. And like with weblogs, it's the quality varies widely, not just audio quality, but, whether they're saying anything worth listening to. I'd say that it's shorter is generally better. If you really want people to, especially if it's news content, if you seriously want people to listen to it, I would shoot for 10 minutes or less. And that's going to be a small file to download. That's probably just going to be about 5 or 6 megabytes. And the only thing you need to subscribe to and listen to podcasts is a broadband internet connection, because this would be painful over dial-up, believe me, and some sort of way to listen to MP3 files. It doesn't even have to be a portable MP3 player. You can listen to it on your computer. Heck, I know some people when they're going on a road trip, they'll burn a bunch of podcasts onto a CD and plug it into the CD player in their car.
It's not far enough to be able to do that with your cell phone and stuff like that.
Yes, and that's the next thing. If people are saying, well, not that many people use computers or have MP3 players, this is now in cell phones. The new generation of smart cell phones generally have access to some sort of broadband internet service if people are willing to pay for that. They have USB ports in them. They have memory built into them. And so you could be driving down the road with your little earpiece from your cell phone listening to a podcast, and you don't own an iPod. You don't need it. You got everything you need. And here's the other thing that's interesting. Cell phone penetration is huge among the poorest populations. People who would never use a computer, who would never use the internet, will probably be getting into podcasts. And not only that, they will be making their own, and they're already starting to do that. And they're doing that especially in a lot of parts of the world you wouldn't expect that. Like Serbia and India and Detroit, a lot of the poorest neighborhoods in Detroit, people are starting to do podcasts because they come from very verbal cultures. and this medium makes sense to them. And how are they finding an audience? Word spreads, word of mouth. People tell each other, they find links, they say, here's how you subscribe to it. Is it huge? No. Is it important? I think so. Okay, so, yes, Peter.
You talked about how all this new technology is killing the old media and destroying the business model.
And just changing them, that's all.
What's the business model for this technology?
For
how do you make a living doing podcasting and blogging?
Right now, podcasting, it's not easy to make a living on, but it's getting easier. And here's the thing. Again, it's about niche audiences. And if you have an area of special expertise, especially among people who are currently technologically literate, then it's possible to do podcasts and get advertising for it. One of my favorite podcasts that I listen to is called /.review. There's this major geek discussion board called /., which gives anybody a headache looking at it because there's just too much stuff. This guy, Andy McCaskey, reads /., picks out, 10 interesting items and does a 15-minute podcast every day of just running through, here's what people are talking about on /.. He gets advertisements in for that. He gets sponsorships for that. And he's probably going to go and sell it as a media property so he can be doing it, just as its own entity without just dealing with, occasionally getting advertisements and sponsorships for it.
It's a radio model.
It's a radio model. So you can have the radio model for that. Also, feeds don't necessarily have to be free and open to the public. If you want to, you can put barriers on so only people who have, paid for it can subscribe to a feed. And podcasts get delivered by feeds. So you could be doing a specialized podcast in the way that people have been doing specialized newsletters. And look how much they charge for some of those newsletters. Okay? There's other models for it, too. You could be doing a sponsored podcast, say you might get hired by an organization to cover their conference and podcast out the sessions, which is what SCJ should be doing, and hopefully they will be next year. And there are other models that are... would be basically more public relations oriented. One of the best podcasts that I like comes from the Center for Democracy and Technology. And they do a podcast probably just only about twice a month, but I'm always going to listen to about it because who knows what's happening with freedom of information issues on the internet? It's CDT. And they're, Center for Democracy and Technology. And am I going to go through and read through all the voluminous legal documents that they post on the site about legislation going through the federal government? No, I can't stand that stuff, but I'll listen to somebody talk about it if they know what they're talking about. They still have a wide readership on their website, but they have vastly expanded their audience by going into a different medium because not everybody likes to read about certain things. There's also video blogs, okay? Basically the same thing, a podcast, except you're attaching a video file instead of an audio file. And playing it gets to be a little bit more of an issue because you can't do it on a cell phone or something. You have to do it on your computer. Although there might be video iPods coming out soon.
You're also having a miniaturization of technology. I mean, I think a lot, even on the 15 years I've been covering technology, I mean, this stuff is just amazing. 10 years ago, there was barely an internet.
Yeah,
in 10 years, we may be getting this kind of tech. Right?
Any gizmo you want to get now, wait.
Yeah.
All right, so we're out of time here, but my email address is amy@garan, G-A-H-R-A-N as in Nancy, .com. I've got a bunch of cards up here. And you can contact me, but like I said, I've tried to go through a lot of stuff very quickly, but I can answer individual questions later, either here or online. But I might post it to Contentious.
And that's it for this talk that I gave at the 2005 Conference of the Society of Environmental Journalists at the University of Texas in Austin. Again, my name is Amy Guerin, and I am a content strategist and info provocateur based in Boulder, Colorado. You can find Contentious on the web at contentious.com, and the October 3rd, 2005 posting has the show notes. As always, you can reach me at editor@contentious.com. Thanks. Bye.